Welcome to Leaders and Legends of Online Learning, a podcast dedicated to the experts. Thank you for listening. Each episode, we'll be learning from the world's leading thinkers and practitioners in online learning and linking to ideas relevant to online teaching, working with online learners, and digital education. You can listen to the experts and check their profiles and link to some of their work on our website, www.onlinelearninglegends.com. I'm Mark Nichols, the interviewer in this episode. You'll meet Professor Mark Brown in this episode. Mark is a fellow Kiwi, and our careers have intersected at many stages over the years. Mark is Chair in Digital Learning and Director of the National Institute for Digital Learning with Dublin City University. I'm talking with Professor Mark Brown, Ireland's first Chair in Digital Learning and Director of the National Institute for Digital Learning based in Dublin. Across his career, Mark is a member of the New Zealand Academy of Tertiary Teaching Excellence, a prominent member of several professional bodies, and he has a strong publication record. Mark, it's great to be finally talking with you.
Yes, Mark. I'm looking forward to talking with you as well.
Mark, can we begin with a brief overview of your career and publications?
I often describe my career as having five phases. So very briefly, I didn't start university until I was 25. And so I think there's a lesson there in that, and I won't bore you with the pre-phase, but I began as a mature student and went right through effectively, having begun as a primary school teacher and then continued on through to a PhD. So that's the kind of first phase. And that was at Massey University in New Zealand. Then I went on to become an academic, a faculty member in, I think was the Faculty of Education at the time, went on to become the College of Education at Massey, which was one of the dominant forces at the time. I think about 80% of the postgraduate education market in New Zealand used to study through Massey. And then the third phase was where I sort of got seconded into the dark side, which I describe as being the centre of the university into a leadership role. And so that was within the same institution. And that changed in a number of ways with different titles, but effectively had responsibility at a strategic level for distance education at Massey. The fourth phase is where, after rearing four children with my wife, Denise, we decided that it was time to move, and we moved to Ireland, and you introduced me with my current role. And my fifth phase, I guess I'm seeing right now, to be honest, Mark, one never can quite predict the future, can we? But the post-COVID-19 era, I see as a whole new phase, and I would hate to speculate on where that might take us all. But I think it's exciting times in many respects. In terms of publications, an important thing about my career, I've always seen myself in my academic work as a scholarly professional, as distinct from a professional scholar. So I place a high value on work that really has impact. And that can operate at different levels, at a macro, a meso, or a micro level. My very first publication actually was in the journal Research and Science Education in 1992. It had nothing to do with online distance education. At the time, naively, I thought you could do two master's degrees at the same time. So I was doing a master's degree in ecology and one in education. But I kind of went on to explore the early days of the web, a number of publications with virtual practicums with some colleagues in Canada. One that I really... still to this day recall as seminal was working with Professor John Codd at the time, who was a professor of policy at Massey. And I learned a lot from John on a project on future scenarios for education. That was a funded project with the New Zealand Ministry of Education. And in a similar vein, because I have a really keen interest in policy as both a barrier and an enabler, our good colleague Bill Anderson, we worked on a project, again funded by the New Zealand Ministry, looking at global lessons in e-learning policy around the world. That was in the early 2000s. I think we published a bit in about 2006, 2007. And so that policy dimension you'll see come through my work in a number of ways. Perhaps another dimension to what I've done, one of my other projects that I'm proud of is where we got our hands dirty, if you like, in looking at the student experience as an online distance learner in their own words. That was funded at the time out of some Australian funding from the D-Hub. And so we used video diaries of first-time learners published quite extensively about that. And of course, looking at the whole issue of retention completion, which is still a topical issue. So that's probably enough of an oversight, other than to say I have a philosophy that I've tried to keep. And if there's one thing that I still hold to this day in everything that I do, either it be administratively or around research and teaching, I'm always looking for the light that comes through the cracks. So I don't see much point in just replicating research that others have done so you get another publication on your vitae. I don't really think that's much value at all. And I'm looking for new knowledge coming through the light that comes through the cracks.
Excellent. Thanks, Mark. That's a really effective metaphor. Now, we met in your phase two, didn't we? You actually employed me at Massey University in the College of Education. And it's also...
Are you willing to acknowledge that?
that's a long time ago. It was 15 odd years ago.
It's too long to think about.
It is. And of course, during that time too, I also met Bill Anderson, who later went on to supervise my PhD. So our careers have been a little bit intertwined. And Mark, I think particularly in professional membership, I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about your professional membership over the years and what that's meant to you as a professional.
Before I do that, I'm going to give you one little snippet that just to give you a sense of how your work can make a difference. Today, Mark, I was involved in a project with a body that has a theology dimension, an online theology dimension. And about 6 weeks ago, I pointed out your thesis to them. And they were just reporting how valuable your thesis was to the work that we're doing with this project, which is related to some work in Africa. But I just thought I could give you that little vignette, if you like. To answer your question, again, this is very much dear to a philosophy that I have. We're probably all familiar with connectivism. In short, knowledge exists in the network. I place a lot of value on being in networks. I have my limits. I know my limits more than probably most people do. But the amplification and the distributed nature of cognition, both at an individual level, but in the community sense. So I, of course, as we both contributed to what was then DEANS, the Distance Education Association of New Zealand, now FLANS. I went on also to play a role in Ascolyte, which doesn't strictly focus just on distance education, but ended up as treasurer up there. And since I've been in Europe, I've been quite active in organizations like EDEN, another professional body, probably lesser known down under, is called the European Consortium of Innovative Universities. So I chaired the Teaching and Learning Committee there. And then for my sins at the moment, I'm also involved with ODLA. So I still like to keep that connection down under. And I also maintain my links into the Online Learning Consortium in the US. So those networks, I just can't put a value on what they are professionally in keeping you engaged, aware of what's going on, really well networked.
Now, Mark, one thing I've always admired about you is your excessive energy. You seem to get a whole lot accomplished. You're certainly doing a lot of energetic work at Dublin City University, DCU. What's the source of your energy? What actually motivates you?
I'll give you two answers to that question. One at a personal note, because a lot of people still ask me to this day. We've been in Ireland for about 6.5 years. How can we move to Ireland? And there are good professional reasons, but the personal reason is so we could get away from the kids, our four grown-up kids now. So that's given us a lot more energy, I have to say. But more seriously, I'm driven by impact. If I think that I can make a contribution, I know it sounds quite cliche-like in many respects, but yes, I can publish in those top journals if I want to, and we have a pretty strong record with the team that we've built, which is another philosophy that this doesn't happen on your own. But ultimately, I actually have this on my Twitter banner, good leaders build more leaders that don't build followers. And so the building something and a legacy and making a contribution is what really drives me. Of course, you know, finding new knowledge and pushing boundaries, finding the light in the cracks, if you like.
Great. Mark, you mentioned earlier the DE Hub funded research project In Their Words, which I think is a first year look at the student experience in distance education. What were some of the major themes and findings from that particular piece of research?
Well, that's taking us back a while, but interestingly, that work still lives in a number of projects that we have. And just since I mentioned it, we're working right now. We have some special COVID-19 research funding to build a MOOC on learning how to learn online. And that will be available on the FutureLearn platform. There's a research dimension that's wrapped around that linked to emotions and learning. But one of the takeaways from the study down under, and that was with colleagues at Charles Sturt University as well, is that a lot of things we thought we knew about the student experience, when you saw it and heard it in their own words by video diaries, actually we had to rethink quite a number of things. So one very, very important takeaway, at the time, the literature on the study life cycle, heaps and heaps of focus on the first few weeks of study, the first 6 weeks, and then so on with many interventions. But one of the single most, if not the most important period when someone sets out to think about the study is before they're formally registered or enrolled. And that's a really tough area to research because they are not students at this point. But the decisions they make at that time and the kind of interventions we might put in place are really powerful. So we, to this day at DCU, have a suite of tools that came out of that research. One is a simple quiz on, am I ready to be a distance online learner? Another is a study life calculator. Have I got enough time to study? These are all takeaways that came out of that research. And then perhaps the second takeaway is, the study originally was going to be just for 6 weeks, which was in the literature a crucial period for student success. But actually after 6 weeks, we were struck with a bit of an ethical dilemma as well as a research challenge. Ethically, the students, this intervention of the video diary as a reflective exercise had become quite powerful in their own learning experience. So we could hardly take it away. Even though we didn't have funding at the time to continue, but ethically we were just committed to continuing. And the research aspect that came from that was actually we discovered that there was a second trough, if you like, or a second peak, depending on which metaphor you want to use. And all the interventions in the six-week period, I think you'll be familiar with Ormond Simpson's work, and Ormond talks about almost like goulash, throwing something else at the problem and hoping it'll stick. Actually, it was around about 10 weeks into their study, towards the three-quarter mark, where there was another crisis point in terms of continuation. And that was something that, again, practically, I know at my previous university, we shifted some of our interventions from that first 6 weeks into that later period. Generally, what we know from the literature is you get them through that first semester or the first year, and then you'll find that retention is not the same challenge.
Yeah. So, Mike, you talked earlier about researching where the light shows through the cracks or searching for the light through the cracks. You've done some really important work in that area. What can you drag from your shelf of research publications, some of the ideas and themes that your work has provided that are very pertinent today?
Well, there are sort of three pillars that I think of in terms of the work. And in the middle of those pillars is that kind of metaphor of the light, which really is another way of saying critique. But the first is around mindsets, perhaps pedagogical mindsets, if you like, but the root of this is just what we know from such a wealth of research, you know, over decades, that the pedagogical orientation, the belief of the instructor, the teacher, the administrator, or the educational leader, those beliefs really mediate what they then do by way of interventions with or without new technologies. So putting a strong focus on there, and particularly from a teaching perspective, the pedagogical beliefs and mindsets. Then the second part of that equation, if you like, or pillar, the second pillar is around leadership. And this is not the hero leader. This is what we understand about distributed leadership. The impact that micro leaders play and the importance of thinking, if you like, again, I mentioned this previously, from a micro through to a macro level or even the nano level, really, really crucial. And so I've put a lot of work. I've got a doctoral student working right now in that area. And the third part of this, you could even visualize this in the center, but I see critique in the middle, is around culture. organisational culture, a discipline culture, because culture has many different meanings. And actually, in a large organisation, there's no such thing as a single culture. It's the subcultures that make up the culture and the tensions between those cultures. And when I talked about previously that I embarked once on two master's degrees, one in ecology, I still bring to my work a really strong ecological perspective on the work that we do and the challenges we face, as well as the opportunities. Mm. So that's probably the best sort of way of summarizing how I see the various parts of the work that I'm engaged in. And as I say, they operate at different levels.
Mm. So Mark, I'm really fascinated by just reflection that your work focuses on leadership, institutional context, culture, student experience. It's not the usual sort of pedagogy, student teaching and learning sort of research which others are involved with. How well does your work complement that landscape in research, do you think?
Well, part of being a scholarly professional, to use my own word, is the nexus that exists between teaching and research, and I should add service as well. So I take quite a amount of pride in that, and it's not something that happens by chance. So the first thing that springs to my mind as an example or another illustration is only 10 days or so ago, we were celebrating, or celebrating might not be the best of word, we were at least recognising World Refugee Day back in June. And so at DCU, we have a suite of scholarships for refugees and asylum seekers. But alongside the work that we've done there, and that falls under my leadership, we've also had a research track, a strand that's been looking at the student experience of these refugees and asylum seekers. Two publications this year alone in that space, and I need to acknowledge I'm not the lead author on those publications or the lead researcher, but that's also by design. So there's a good example of that nexus in the work we're doing, and more around that you rightly pointed out, sort of student experience, but that's wrapped into the other dimensions I talked about, because if we don't have the right mindsets, first and foremost, DCU, where I work, was the island's first university of sanctuary. I don't even know of a university of sanctuary in Australia or New Zealand. I don't think that concept even comes into the consciousness.
So what is a University of Sanctuary, Mark, just for those of us who may not have heard
it? It's an official designation, and of course context matters here, but the world has a major challenge around refugees and asylum seekers and the flight of people. There are more wars going on right now. Hunger and poverty are bigger problems they've been than ever in our history. So this is a commitment to social justice. It's a commitment to action. And Europe in particular, of course, over recent times, that's been a very high profile challenge that we've faced with people coming from particularly Africa and other parts of the Middle East region. Not to say that countries like Australia and New Zealand, who are known as good citizens in this space, aren't doing good things as well, but it's just my point was around the mindset here. So if you begin with the mindset, and I'm really driven by the fact that when I said make a difference, make a contribution, the university that I work at has a mission of transforming lives and societies. And this isn't weasel words, as some institutional missions can be. So it's driven, is another expression, as the money is on the mission. And I don't mean that in a business sense, but the focus is very much on that mission. So whether that's being in research or actually in practice or service activities, I try to bring those together.
It's really interesting to hear your own humanitarian values come through there. Thanks, Mike. Look, we're now partway through 2020. In fact, we're halfway through. We've had obviously a busy start to the year. What are your observations about online education at the present time?
Just about everyone's become an expert. Well, certainly in my part of the world, plenty of people have a lot to say about what online education looks like. I've got a little tired of the 7 handy hints or the 10 principles for online education. I'm as guilty as others, because in the early days I contributed some of those as well, and I have a feeling you did too, Mark. But we're a bit overwhelmed with principles and handy hints. So that's a little bit of a more critical kind of comment. And following on that, I'm also disturbed, I think would be the right word, with the deficit language that has been just accepted in the discourse. And what I'm referring to, and it may have been a little different down under, although my sources would suggest otherwise, emergency remote teaching, teaching in isolation, where in which we began with the conception that whatever we're going to be doing wasn't going to be as good as face-to-face. Face-to-face was the default gold standard that we were going to measure anything against. And of course, most people would admit that what happened in the rapid pivot, to use that word as well, that's now in our discourse for a period, we weren't, of course, designing with intent for, as we would normally, a really engaging online distance experience. But nonetheless, that deficit language, I think, is quite a challenge. And a study that I have underway with a colleague right now is actually doing an analysis of how the media has portrayed the pivot to online, because that deficit language is written through the media in the way they told the story about the rapid pivot. And that's another just example of, I guess, you know, looking at a little deeper for the light coming through the cracks there. Another element that I would say, and it's interesting, Mark, you talked about, we use the word online here. We're still in this challenge in the convergence and figuring out whether online is distance education or not. In some contexts it might be, in others it's not. And what do we define as online? There's a great paper published a couple of years ago now in the American Journal of Distance Ed with the definitions of online, because no one has a common definition. And then another takeaway, I'm sure you probably had the same experience. I got sick of the number of offers that came my way from commercial partners, or they were seeing themselves as partners, and the cold, hard reality of online education, I'll use that terminology for now, is it's big business. And in fact, the projections that have come through in recent weeks, I've published something, I think, citing some of these, they differ depending on who you read, but we are talking a multi-billion industry and projected to double pretty much in the next 5 to 7 years. So we ain't seen nothing yet, some would say. And alongside that, business interests, which I have to say isn't all bad, a little being business-like is not necessarily a bad thing, but the tension between what's often referred to as unbundling, which is actually probably better described as rebundling, and understanding the tensions between the competing drivers. So just this morning, I woke up to an email where one of my doctoral students submitted overnight his final draft of his thesis, because it had to be in by the end of June. He's been looking at the policy drivers around online education in Ireland. And in the discourse analysis of the policy, the economic drivers, as distinct from the pedagogical and teaching and learning drivers, are the dominant ones. So there's this kind of a tension here between the knowledge economy versus what might be seen as a more noble ambition and tradition, particularly here in Europe, of the learning society or knowledge society. And then final comment, I'll wrap in all of this, and it comes back to my fifth phase that I was talking about in my own career. People like Sean Bain and others are now talking post-digital. And so how do we rethink what we're doing, reimagine it in a way, because the digital aspect and online, of course, and digital, what do they mean? They go synonymously. What's coming next? And rephrasing it rather than say what's coming next, actually, what kind of society and good outcomes do we want in the future? And how do we set out about to design those? And you don't still hear enough people, apart from the Sustainable Development Goals, often anchoring that conversation. But for me, the Sustainable Development Goals themselves have become at risk of being borrowed by the discourse for different ends.
Mark, there's a lot to pick up there. I think where I'll go with that is, what is your preferred future here? How would you design a future online education system that you think would be optimal?
Wow, if I would say that we've just had a new Minister of Education, actually in Ireland, we've just had a quite a historic change, because we have a government finally over the weekend after about 4 months, 5 months of no government, but we've created a new Ministry of Higher Education, Science and Development. So we do have a new minister, and sometimes that's a good interview question. So I'm now the one having to look at it. First and foremost, we need to face some of the cold, hard realities. Education has been highly successful, and I'm talking about compulsory education from K-12 schooling through to universities, in reproducing privilege. And this isn't always something that sits comfortably. It's an uncomfortable reality, but I'm a first in family to go to university, so I see this as something that's very dear to my heart, the amplification effects of education. So education for all, I know it's a cliche, but it is not something we've been able to deliver on. We only needed 1% of what was spent on weapons in one single year to have met the target for the Millennium Goals to get every child to go to school. 1% of one annual year's budget on weapons is all it would have taken, yet we failed. So for me, I'm not giving you the answer of what the perfect system is, but for me, ultimately, the education system we develop, or systems, are there to serve society. So the answer to your question is, what type of good society do we want to create and use our education system to be a key lever and driver for? For me, the good society is one where everyone is looked after. Everyone has an opportunity. We certainly wouldn't have, and it's a sad commentary, I'm afraid, on life in Dublin, the beggars that are on the streets. Even if I go outside from where I live right now, I can guarantee there'll be two beggars who are almost permanently there. Now, that's a simplistic analysis, but I'm not comfortable with a society like that, and I see education as part of the solution.
Mark, I've been looking forward to your answer to this next question. What research would you most like to see if you had I won't say unlimited, but a very healthy research budget, where would you invest it?
That's a great question. And I'm going to perhaps even contradict some of the things I've said previously, in part because I haven't done much in this area. It's an area that I've flagged to a number of colleagues, but it's going to be very difficult to operationalize. So what is the area I'm talking about? I'm talking about the costs, the returns, and the impact at a kind of macro level. To put it another way, the public and private benefits of an investment in alternative models of education. I'll say it in that language rather than just exclusively online or distance. And why that area? Probably for me, the single biggest challenge we face in education around the world is the question of who pays.
Yeah.
Linked to that question of who pays, and no one has solved that problem to my knowledge. You know, you have the model in the United States where largely the user pays, and the outcome of that is trillions in student debt. You have a reverse or opposite of that in parts of Europe where education is completely free, but that hasn't entirely brought access to everyone. So this question of who pays also links to the models of delivery and design and delivery, if you like, because if we can establish that actually there is a return on investment, wash my mouth out, but I'll use that language, that there is a public and private benefit on the investment in other modes of delivery other than campus-based. I say other than campus-based because we already have the research on the campus-based education. We know conclusively that there is a return on investment, both private and public, but we don't have the evidence to show that actually that return is just as strong, if not even stronger, because there's no bricks and mortar being extended by state for other ways of teaching and learning. So it's really an economic study.
Yeah, is it Greville Rumble you're citing there?
Yeah, sorry, I should have thrown that in, but you're like me, you're old enough and wise enough to know who you need to go and read. But there hasn't really been anyone that has followed Rumble's work in the kind of substantive way that he started out.
Absolutely.
Started out, that's a not quite a fair synopsis of the line of research. In Hong Kong, one published study did include in their census the mode of delivery around their qualifications. But most studies, even here in Ireland, about 2 months ago, we released a national study of the digital learning experience, tracking the students and the academics, the teachers. And that study did not disaggregate data with a question on mode of delivery.
Right. So there is a serious gap in knowledge there.
Yes.
Mark, it's always really fascinating to talk with you. And I honestly do wish I could go on for another hour or so, but I know you don't have the time. But who are two people you'd recommend as legends of online learning? One whose work or perspective is significantly influencing you now, and one who you think otherwise has an important perspective to share.
The first person I'm going to mention is someone who I had the privilege last week to serve on an online panel. And I have an enormous amount of respect. And I'm talking about Diana Lollard. And the reason I mentioned Diana is because Diana has been there and done it. She has served as a policymaker in a high-profile government position. Obviously, her work, her seminal work, which is still being used today, even at a very practical level at DCU, where we've been actually quite influential in what's called the ABC Learning Design Framework, which is based on Diana's conversational theory. But Diana has also put theory into practice. And so I was delighted to be able to contribute with Diana earlier in the year when we were at the height of the challenges in Ireland, in particular around the pivot to online learning, because we worked with FutureLearn to produce a MOOC. That particular MOOC, that's the panel discussion last week we were talking about, has just won an award. There were 70,000 educators around the world ended up doing that MOOC. And of course, MOOCs tend to polarize people, but 14,000 people went through to certificate of attainment level, over 20%. Right. That's 14,000 people learned quite a lot about how to teach online. So Diana, I think, ticks just so many boxes, and there's still much that she can contribute and does. The second person is more true to my original sort of light comes through the cracks, which I hope doesn't sound too cliche or slogan-like. And this is a person whose career I've been involved with really from the very early days. He wouldn't normally be seen as someone who would be in the distance education area, and I'm referring to Neil Selwyn. I had a long relationship with Neil when he was in the London Knowledge, in the Knowledge Lab at UCL, and of course now at Monash. Neil is one of those people who sees things as a critic and through a different lens. But what more in recent years, Neil's also had to take that critique and do something with it, because I kind of get a little turned off by what I'll call those who are critical, because being critical has become almost popular now, who are in some respects framed by the pedagogy of the depressed. There's a place for critique and for people sitting outside to see things differently. But ultimately, if you don't make a difference and contribute and put your theories and ideas into practice, sitting on the outside only goes so far. So Neil's done that in more recent times. And then at another level, if I could write as well as Neil, I'd be very happy.
Thanks, mate. It's been wonderful talking with you. I've really enjoyed, again, sitting at your feet and just learning the things of your heart. Mark, thank you very much for being a leader and legend of online learning.
Well, thanks for the privilege of talking with you, and I hope we'll be able to catch up sooner rather than later in New Zealand.
I certainly hope so too. Thanks, mate. You can learn more about Mark and his work from our website. That concludes this episode. Be sure to go to our website, www.onlinelearninglegends.com, to follow up on this episode's guest. You'll also find links to others whose ideas continue to inspire and teach online learning professionals, and you can subscribe to future interviews. If you know of a leader or legend we've not yet talked to, please do drop us a line at onlinelearninglegends@gmail.com.